Please welcome to the stage, Doug DiRuggiero. Douglas has been in clinical practice for 25 years. He loves to teach, lecture, and mentor. He and his wife currently live in a dormitory on the campus of Berry College in Rome, Georgia. He is a certified master gardener, a chaplain for the local jail, and the owner of an impressive collection of over 30 airline barf bags, all of them unused.
You know, in 1994 is when Joe Monroe had the idea of starting our society. 49 members were a part of the first group. When I joined the society, I was member number 178. It was on my membership card. And I remember the very first conference we held. It was called a CME symposium. It was the day prior to the winter AAD in 2002. And it was so much of a success and enough people interested in it that it was the very next year, 2003, that we branched out on our own and started our own conference. That first conference was held in New Orleans. I don't know if anybody here was part of that. And then our second standalone conference in 2003 was in San Antonio. I feel like I'm ringing. Am I ringing to you guys? So we've come a long way. I've had the honor of being at every SDA conference since they started. Now we've went to two a year. I haven't been at both of those every year, but I've been in at least one conference for the 22 years we've been doing these. And I've had the honor of speaking at 20 of them. So today I'm talking to you about kind of finding the right treatment for your patient who has psoriasis. And I did a similar talk in 2000 to this group, but lots of things have been added since then. There may be some similar themes, but my theme is always this. Make sure you know what you're diagnosing, because you'll never have a right treatment if you've got the wrong diagnosis. And always put the patient first. Because while we have 12 biologics now approved, two orals, multiple topicals, a lot of old treatments, the best treatment for your patient is the thing that fits their needs best. And so, no, there's a lot of pressure when you stand up here doing this, because every pharmaceutical company is sitting around the periphery. What's he gonna say about our product, you know? I'll tell you this right now, I love them all. I've used them all. I put my first patient on a biologic November 2nd, 1998. That's the day that Etanercept became commercially available. And I put a patient on it the very first day that that medicine became available. And so I've used them for a long time. And all I can say is that I'm happy to have so many options. I tell patients all the time, this is a great time to be living with psoriasis because I have so many options to offer you. And these options are gonna radically change your life. And I think it's very important to speak that way to your patients. They need to hear that there's hope, that there's positivity to a disease that they're carrying. The fact is that if someone develops liver dysfunction or liver failure or develops macular degeneration and becomes blind, to the public that brings kind of a sense of sympathy and empathy. But when someone develops a disease of the largest organ of the body and it's visibly kind of repulsive, it doesn't bring sympathy. It brings repulsion. And so that's why we deal with patients who have so many emotional issues tied to what they're bringing into the room. Almost every patient that's got something that's significant enough for them to pay a $75 copay to come see me are walking in with a large invisible backpack. That's a huge weight that's upon them, whether or not they admit it or not. And I like to acknowledge that and let them know. So thank you for all the companies that sponsor me and have. So this is the question that I get from residents all the time, students. How do you choose which treatment? Well, I'll tell you now, it's based on the severity of the disease, the age of the patient, past treatments they've tried, the drug delivery, the impact on the quality of life, and the big one, insurance coverage. Fact of the matter is that we all can admit, should admit, maybe won't admit, that a lot of our decisions are made by 19 and 20 year old MAs. We walk out of a room and they say, please don't write that. Well, why? The last three times we've had to fight for a month to get someone on it. Okay, well, based on their insurance, which one should I write? This one's easier. Okay, well, we'll do that one. And all of that big knowledge and all the studies and everything else gets funneled into someone out in the hallway and once you leave the room telling you this is probably the best thing to get them on rather than having to fight. Now it's a reality I think most of us live in and most drug companies don't want to hear. but it's there. So what is psoriasis? You know, and this is a pivotal article, 1979. We had two Swiss rheumatologists who put four patients on a brand new medication that had just come out. Ciba-Geigy had developed a medicine called cyclosporin. Ciba-Geigy is a Swiss company. These Swiss rheumatologists got their hands on it pretty early, put four people on it who had psoriatic arthritis and psoriasis and saw their psoriasis clear. Didn't really work too well for their joints, but man, their skin got better. And these two gentlemen proposed that psoriasis is not what I was trained in med school at the time in the 60s and 70s as being just a problem with dysfunctional keratinocytes. But we propose that because cyclosporin works on T-cell differentiation, that this is a T-cell driven disease. It's the first time anyone had proposed that idea, and it completely changed the trajectory of how we viewed psoriasis at that point. Kind of a pivotal New England Journal of Medicine, half page, tiny little article that kind of changed the way we view it. So is this autoimmune disease? Well, it's really not, because technically by being autoimmune, it means that you have to develop an autoantigen that you can actually see and find and test and prove. We've never been able to find that. Now, there are 770 genes that have been implicated in the disease of psoriasis, but not that one gene nor that one antigen that's being formed in order to drive this. But it doesn't mean it's not immune-driven. In fact, there's this now this term, the psoriasis-associated autoimmunity spectrum, because there's so much overlap that takes place with psoriasis and multiple other diseases. Autoimmune thyroid, increased incidence of SLE, increased incidence of, obviously, no cardiovascular joint problems. But we've got a lot of autoimmune problems, increased incidence of MS. In fact, psoriasis by itself, if you hear anything at all, psoriasis by itself is its own black box warning. The disease is a black box warning. If you have psoriasis, your black box warning is you have a greater chance of developing a fatty liver, liver disease, metabolic syndrome, cardiac disease, and you have an overlap. At least 2% to 6% of all psoriasis patients will develop IBD and have it at the time of diagnosis when they don't even know it. We've done that. We've looked at studies looking at fecal calciprotein, which is the harbinger saying you're heading towards IBD. And we got 2 to 6% of patients who come in with no complaints of the GI at all, and they later develop IBD, and they already had the indication of it. So we have a lot of these overlaps of these autoimmune-driven diseases that are associated with psoriasis. So, how do you know it's psoriasis? Well, this is your classic circinate plaque. Circinate means solid, right? Sharply demarcated, not ill-defined. So which one of these is psoriasis? Are they all? Only the one in the middle. You can see there on your left, you see that nummular eczema. You can see in the center is the plaque. You can see on the far right, the lichenified atopic dermatitis. Hard for me to point it out, but you can see the sharply demarcated border on the bottom edge of the nummular eczema, and then it becomes more ill-defined at the top portion. That is a good clinical clue that you're dealing with nummular eczema. It tends to have one portion that's sharply demarcated and the other that is not. It's asymmetrical in its border definition in different ways. And the way you identify lichenification versus plaque is that you can see that psoriasis is hyperproliferative. These cells are stacking up on top of one another. They can't slough off fast enough. From the time a cell leaves the basal layer and makes it to the top of the striatum corneum, it's about 35 to 42 days before it dries out and sloughs off and flakes onto your bedside table. When you put a speedometer on a psoriatic plaque, it's turning over about every 9 to 12 days. It is revved up, and those cells are going pushed so fast to the top that it forms that plaque. That's why it's erythematous. That's why it looks different than the rubbed skin that has lichenified itself. On skin of color, very different presentation. Not the erythema, more white, more hyperpigmentation, more darkly colored. You can see this example in this gentleman here. He's got areas that are previously cleared. When he was on therapy, a biologic came off of it. His plaques began to recur, came in to see me to try to get reinstituted. And I was like, let's make sure that's what this is, because you know, plaque stage CTCL can look a lot like early stage psoriasis. So of course I did a biopsy because I didn't want to miss something like this. Plaque stage mycosis fungoides, and it's a good thing to always question yourself. It can be elephantine and thick like this, as you can see on the arms as well, both patients of mine. It can be circinate and annular in its presentation. A lot of people say I've never heard of that before, but these are psoriatic plaques with central clearing, right? This is on the right side is a six-year-old, and the other one's on the back. So we can see annular presentation of that. and then your classic plaques, which can be all over, can be guttate, can begin to connect as we move across. But look at this case here, rare nipple areola psoriasis. Very unusual presentation. I've only found 3 cases in the literature, but by biopsy, proven to be so. Because you can see like a cancerous transformation, acanthoma or Paget's disease, but again, we're developing differential diagnosis, whether it's Bowen's carcinoma or nummular eczema or atopic dermatitis, which I think all of nipple dermatitis, quote unquote, is really AD of the nipple itself. So all I'm saying is that develop differential diagnosis for these different areas and don't ever assume that something is a slam dunk case in your brain. You always want to be questioning yourself to make sure you're doing it. Even pitting of the nail. I mean, if you stood outside the door and you're in a derm residency and they say, well, all right, give me 5 other things that can pit a nail, you should be able to say alopecia areata, sarcoidosis, pemphigus vulgaris, right? All these things do it. Reactive Reiter's disease, contact dermatitis, chronic can do it, and certainly AD as well. So you just want to look at those and look for other clues, the oil drop stains, the salmon patches. And, as you see here, this proximal, now you see a little tiny pit in that. This is another photo from my camera. That proximal nail changes. Proximal destruction is a sign of psoriatic nail disease, and it's not one that's commonly listed. Here's another pediatric patient with proximal nail destruction, and you can see that that is related to the psoriasis. Behind the ears, on the scalp, can be severe on the scalp with alopecia, scabbing, weeping. This is psoriasis. And underneath the breast, in the groin folds, when it's intertriginous, sharply demarcated, and look at the difference in the presentation on psoriasis inverse under the breast and white skin versus darkly colored skin. You can see the difference in that erythema. But again, the differential, inverse, intertrigo, candidiasis, Hailey-Hailey, erythrasma. All of these things are presentations we see under the breast and tinea versicolor, and you want to always be looking about sharply demarcated, is there a scale, and how does it feel, what does it feel like? So all of these things are to say, make sure you know what you're treating. Furthermore, when we ask our questions about, do you have psoriasis in your joints? Morning stiffness, I know, is what we always ask about. Grace Wright has taught us, a great rheumatologist in New York, that in females, over 40% of women do not present with lower back stiffness. Their stiffness presents in the upper thoracic and cervical spine in the morning. So they may not answer your question, do you have a low back stiffness? They may interpret their upper back stiffness as picking up their child all the time or doing certain work or getting up in the morning, and that's how it may present. Furthermore, pelvic pain is common in women too. Misdiagnosis pelvic inflammatory disease is actually referring from the sacroiliac into the buttocks or into the pelvic itself. In fact, almost 40% of patients who have perceived SI joint problems are actually psoriatic arthritis complaints that are radiating to the buttocks and down to the knee. TMJ is another ones you want to ask about, so all of these areas. So do you have the correct diagnosis? All right. So what triggers it now? Do you know what it is and what triggers it? Well, stress. We're talking about treatments for psoriasis. Look at this meta-analysis. 32,000 patients in this meta-analysis, 54% saying that a preceding stressful event is what initiated their psoriasis, 46% almost half saying that their psoriasis is reactive to a stressful event in their life. This is why I tell pharmaceutical companies all the time, there is no product that works 100% of the time for 100% of the people. Even if you get a PASI 100 and you're PASI 100 a year out, there is still a chance that you're gonna hit your dog in the driveway, your wife's gonna leave you, you're gonna lose your job, your house is gonna burn down. Something can happen and your psoriasis can flare. Does it mean that that medicine is failing and that you need to change? No, it means that we're dealing with a disease, that our lives are full of stress and our lives can impact our disease because of that. And studies show that. In fact, if you put somebody through relaxation therapy, their psoriasis improves. 2 different studies, one from 1998, one from 2020, so an old and a new, showing that meditation, look at the one on the right, mindful meditation, 4-fold increase in being able to reach a PASI 90 score with phototherapy versus those that did not have that. So I think we kind of missed the boat on asking our patients, are they in some type of counseling? Do they have a support group? What's the support group at home? Would they consider anything else along those lines? This is not new. If you go back to the oldest recorded document we have in Persian texts, we have an entry in that from a physician. It was only 1840 that the Western world differentiated leprosy from psoriasis. 1,000 years prior, they'd already done that in the Persian world, all right? And so, and already this case here is a gentleman is being described, and you see the date on that, 1,200 years ago, as having a stressful event which erupted psoriasis on his body, and then the physician used interpersonal reduction of stress in his life to improve it. 1,200 years ago. All right, can we make it go away? You can see one of my first CME certificates. This is how we used to do it, folks. We used to turn in our Social Security number, all right, and our date of birth and our phone number on a form to the AAPA, you know, to get our CME. But you look at Raptiva. I had a gentleman come to, Dr. Neil Cormick come and give a lecture to our GDPA group in Georgia on Raptiva. It's maybe a product you've never even heard of because it was on the market and came off the market. So lots have changed. I would have never dreamed I'd have 20 new approved products for psoriasis in my prescribing career. That's what's happened. You know, I've been doing dermatology for 23 years, and in 23 years, 20 new products have been approved in those 23 years. But the old never goes away, right? So the phototherapy, we go back a long ways. And we're talking about Egyptians and Persians and Asian and the Orient, all these areas having documents using light therapy and color therapy, using certain blue for inflammatory skin, red for fever. They have all these different documentations of different colored light on them, but we know it's probably just sunlight in general. And so even Hippocrates used and coined the phrase heliotherapy. And then it kind of got concentrated, and Finneson won the Nobel Prize for using concentrated light radiation. And then we're now using phototherapy. So phototherapy needs to be considered still part of your armamentarium. It's great for thin plaques, not for anything that's scalp inverse, et cetera, et cetera. Great for pregnancy because of its safety and breastfeeding. Anyone's got a contraindication to systemics. But not good for those who burn easily, history of skin cancer, lupus, PMLE, on medications that are photosensitizing, et cetera, home units are available. What about rubbing stuff on the skin? Well, you know, again, the Egyptians have been doing it a long time. We now have, this is an awesome article if you want to read about skin diseases in mummies. This is an awesome article because it talks about all the things that they've discovered through going back through and doing a PCR analysis on the skin of these mummies, finding out that they were using bleaching products for ochronosis, a form of hydroquinone. They were using a form of anthracene and crude coal tar. And so a number of things that were being used 3,500 years ago for skin diseases. But, you know, we move it up. In 1952, topical steroids were finally brought to the forefront by Marion Sulzberger, and it kind of broke the tyranny of TARS using Geckerman therapy light and people being wrapped in plastic for 3 weeks in a row. Let me tell you, Geckerman therapy is still used in only two locations in the United States today, in San Francisco at the Mayo Clinic. And people still do it. They give up 3 weeks of their lives. Why? Because the PASI 100 rate for that is very high. In fact, they go on an average of 14 to 20 months at PASI 100 after having Geckerman therapy. Now, it's a lot. Rubbed all over your body, wrapped in plastic for 8 hours, have it taken off, then you go into light therapy. But it's something that's been done. But steroids kind of broke that tyranny, famously said. So if we're talking about treatment of psoriasis, you can't overlook the topicals as something that's been there for a long time. Got a little bit of some action between 2000 and 2020, but really all the action's been taking place recently with our PDE4 antagonist and our oral carbon receptor inhibitors and new combinations that are out. If you want to read about the new ones out, I did a series of articles on Matt Zyrus in Skin Magazine that talks about all the phase 1, 2, and 3 data on those, on our three new novel topicals that have come out, with ruxolitinib not being for psoriasis, but the other two, yes. All right, so back to the same question. How do you decide to put them on the big stuff? All right, severity, okay. When do we put someone on something that's systemic? You know, how do you move off of topicals to systemic? You know, and how do we get the insurance company? Well, is it severity? Is it based on BSA? Is it based on sensitive areas? Yes and yes. We, you know, classically look at it in this way, with our mild, moderate, and severe, with mild being justifiable for topicals, and then your more moderate to severe being justifiable for systemics. Thank goodness the International Psoriasis Council kind of stepped up to the podium a few years ago, 100 dermatologists nationwide, and said, look, we're no longer going to define it just based on BSA. We're going to allow past failed medical treatments, impact on quality of life, and involvement of sensitive areas to be the justification to go on systemic medications. So basically, and if we put them on systemics, we want to push them to a BSA of 1% or less is what the treatment goals are. Nice to have that. Okay, so we got a decision tree now. And the decision tree is saying to us, this is printed, this is a kind of a neat article that came out, you know, that Dr. Monks and Leb Wall, and Leb Wall's coming to speak to us tomorrow, looking at this is a way to maybe decide this. So I think the easiest thing for you to do, and the easiest way for me to condense my talk, is just for you to memorize this tree. and everything that's on the end of it, you know, because that's a great way of doing it. But what I think this has some utility, and it's a lot of repeated names that are through it. This came out in 2021, so things have even happened since then. But when you look at this, the main bifurcation in this tree is whether or not the patient has skin only or skin and joint. And that's how they've kind of separated it out, if I were to split this diagram. I don't think that's a bad way to view it, except to say this. You don't know who's really going to develop joint problems. So the folks that are skin only, we hear this magic number of 30% will eventually, you know, develop joint problems. I think it's higher, personally, it's in my clinical practice, right? I don't think we'll ever get an accurate number for that because so many people are on systemics, and these systemics are protecting joints. So, but you don't know who the 30% is going to be if we're going to be married to that number, all right? So I like to cover everything. You know, to be honest, I like to be on products that cover everything because I know that you go 6 months with an erosive change in a joint, it ain't coming back. It's not coming back. We can see the skin remodel itself. You can see hyperpigmentation and erythema eventually fade because the skin turnover is so rapid. You're not seeing this turnover in synovium. And once they lose that joint function, it's gone. But in terms of FDA indication and looking at these different things, this was a major bifurcation to think about things in terms of skin and joint. But things have even swapped on this, you know, like risankizumab. At the time of this publication, guselkumab, you know, Tremfya had the indication for treatment of psoriatic arthritis. Risankizumab, Skyrizi did not. Now, since this has come out, this one moves over from the PSO side only, and it comes over here to it can be used both for skin and joints, right? Furthermore, if you're going to follow this out, here's how to read this chart. I don't know if I can go to the top of the speaker here. If you have skin and joint problems, and you come to the first bifurcation, and you're going to say to them, does this patient have either congestive heart failure or MS, all right? And if they have congestive heart failure and MS, you're going to avoid TNFs. We're going to talk about that in a second, because it's really a contraindication. It's a strong precaution. It's not a black box warning, but to have CHF. So if they've got that, then let's head down this row. If, as you're heading down the row, okay, what do they have IBD? Well, according to these Lebwohl, et cetera, if they got IBD, then you may want to miss out on the 17th. So you're going to head towards the IL-23s. And the three IL-23s that are on there is now guselkumab, ustekinumab, risankizumab. You'll see those listed there. And then Ilumya is on the list as well. If they don't have that, then they can head to the upper bifurcation and go to all these other ones. So this is how you kind of read it. I'm going to try to lay this out in what I think is a little bit of a different format and kind of work through it. So you can see here from this list, we now have 12 biologics. I had to modify this slide last night. I changed it with the speaker's deck this morning. Why? Because bimekizumab, finally the bimmy baby was born. It's been 2 years. It's like an elephant's gestational period, right? You know, they've been pregnant for 2 years, and the bimmy baby was born just 11 days ago, I think October 18th, 10 days ago. So I had to add it on. So now we've got another IL-17. But starting in 1998 with infliximab and etanercept, if you look at that stretch between 2013 and 2019, we had a new biologic being approved every year, one per year for 7 years. I mean, that's how this market was moving and grooving, okay? And so you can see that if we put these in the categories of tissue necrosis factors, our IL-12/23, Stelara, ustekinumab, now have 4/17s, and we've got 3 IL-23s. I don't think this list is gonna change. I think most companies that had a little skin in the game, maybe Lilly's mirikizumab, they've kind of pulled out and said they're gonna go just for Crohn's, and UC indication with that and not with skin with that IL-23. I don't know of, and maybe there's some MSLs in here, I don't know of any products that are going for the psoriasis indication in the biologic world right now that are in these categories. Now, we've got some exciting new molecules that are targeting different things, OX40 inhibitors, SYK inhibitors, salt-inducible kinase inhibitors. We've got a number of different things that are out there that may be there, but they're not going to be on this list. And you can see the bimekizumab at the bottom. And we don't want to lose out on our two orals, or primalast and deucravacitinib. So there's a lot of things in here. Some are indicated for peds, some are indicated for arthritis, some are indicated for Crohn's, some have black box warnings, and this is how I make my decision when I'm talking to a patient. They're going to target different areas, as you see here in this pathway. Wherever they target, you can see as you go from a dendritic cell to a naive T cell, if that naive T cell is exposed to IL-23, it becomes a Th17 cell. If that naive T cell is exposed to IL-12, it can become a Th1 cell. That's the original target that we were coming out with. We were targeting IL-12 early on, but now we know that 23 and 17 and TNF is the major pathway. And then inside the cells, where we're seeing the movement and the activity of apremilast and deucravacitinib as a TYK inhibitor and a PDE4 inhibitor. Apremilast working inside the cell, kind of blocking this transition from cyclic AMP to AMP, and deucravacitinib working on one of the JAK inhibitors. The way I like to think about these cells in general is these are big floating balls with a lot of windows on them. And these windows, think of this floating ball and all these windows as the inside of a girl's dorm at a Catholic school. And all the girls are sitting at the window looking out, seeing if their boyfriend's going to come by and throw a rock at the window. And they can, in the middle of the night, raise the window and talk to them. Well, what these receptor blockers do is they board up the windows so no message can come through. But if a message happens to come through, if they pry it off, or the stone gets tapped on the glass and they open up and they receive the message and it says, meet me outside the basement door in 5 minutes, all right? And they go to run out of the dorm room, and when they open the door, the nun is standing right there. It says, what are you doing? Well, that's what TYK2 is doing. The message has made it inside the cell and they intercept the message inside the cell so they can't be carried and everything can't happen downstream. All right. And these medicines have gotten better as our science has gotten better. Once we figure out where the more specific problem is, then we can develop targeted therapeutics for that. So, you know, I think about it this way. If this is the guy you need to take out, you certainly can do this, all right, and take out everybody. And this is our old DMARDs. This is kind of how methotrexate and cyclosporine and some of these old guys were working, kind of this pan effect, and that's why I want more side effects. You could throw a grenade in the middle of it. You'll probably take out your target, but you'll take out probably 10 or 12 people around it as well. And as we moved into other things, we kind of saw that it was becoming a little more specific, but this is what you want. This is what you want. You want the Navy SEAL sniper. And so we moved into these pharmaceutical snipers now with all of these medications. And I think some are even more targeted than others, but this is the analogy I like to use, because which one works best is what I say. I just want to be on the one that's best, man. Can you give me the best one? Well, the best one's the one that fits your profile. But if we're going to look at just numbers, this is the only time I'm going to compare numbers for you in this. I got this slide from Joel Gelfand, gave it to me with his permission. And you can just run your eyes across there. This is PASI 90 data out of package inserts. This is not head-to-head trial data. And these may have different time frames on when this data was collected. 12, 16, or 24 weeks. So this is not an apples-to-apples comparison, but it does tell you about the report of PASI 90 data at their primary endpoint timestamp, which for most of these companies that are biologics is 16 weeks, okay? And you can run your eye across that and you say, well, why in the world would I ever use apremilast with having that low of a number? Well, let me tell you, it's the second most prescribed systemic medication for psoriasis in the United States. So there's a lot of people using it. And I'm not saying that they're using it for all the wrong reasons. The fact is that apremilast has absolutely no impact on B cell and T cell proliferation. That's why its incidence of infections is almost zero. So if you have someone that you're worried about chronic infections, then maybe this is, and all the biologics I think are safe, but they all have a warning of infections. Right, you can't ignore it, even though you think I don't see it very often in my practice. And so it's got utility. It's got, you know, so it's got, I'm not here to promote one drug over the other. All I'm saying is that I don't throw anybody under the bus. It's a bad thing to do. If you sit there and tell a patient, you know, I wouldn't put my dog on that medicine, you know. And then you walk out and your nurse tells you they have a special version of Atrium Healthcare that only allows us to put them on this medicine first, then you gotta go in there and eat crow, right? And so you gotta say, wasn't that the one you just said that you wouldn't even let your mama take? No, I didn't say that, really. You're gonna do well on this medicine. And it's not that I really don't, because I utilize all of these. So I don't think that PASI is the thing that needs to drive all of our decisions. Because if someone has a certain comorbidity, which we're going to go through, then that medication, no matter how good his posse is not one that you can put them on. That's why shared decision-making is a little bit of a difficult venture in choosing a psoriatic medication. I call it kind of controlled decision-making. I saw a commercial on, it said it could get my skin 90% clear, I want to be on that medication. All right, well, that's great. That's an awesome medication. I have other patients on it. I agree with the commercial. A lot of people are successful. But let me ask you a few questions about your past medical history and make sure that that medicine, because medicines have different classes. And I want to make sure that class of medication is not going to be harmful to you in some other way. Man, patients love that. Instantly, they say they have my best interest in mind. And you may end up having to talk them out of being on that class of medication. All right, because I'm saying, you know, based on the three or four things you've just told me, I kind of think we need to probably pivot to another group that I think is very, very good as well. And so this is the process, I think, of how you make a selection towards a systemic therapy. But you can't hide the numbers in terms of clearance. And clearance is important because it affects their quality of life. And this is the only comparison that you're going to see me make. So broad strokes on oral therapies, right, generally do not have the same efficacy as the biologics. Doesn't mean they're not great. Deucravacitinib certainly has got higher efficacy than in their package inserts data, right, than primolast does. So, I mean, it's novel. You may have issues where you want to talk to one about the GI upset in one, risk of depression, and others. These are the things you have to navigate through. Does it make one product worse than the other? It just makes a product different. The fact is that when I get a headache, Tylenol works fantastic for me to take away headache. Does nothing for my wife. When she gets a headache, she takes 800 milligrams of Advil. That takes away her headache. We both have headaches. Two different medicines work equally as well. And you can't come in and say, well, wouldn't you rather be on morphine? Because that works the best for headaches, doesn't it? So I want to put you on the one that is the strongest and the best. Well, yeah, maybe, you know. So all I'm saying is that you got to look at these individual characteristics. So first and foremost, all monoclonal antibodies are immunosuppressive. I tell patients they're targeted immunosuppressive medications. If you're playing on a soccer team and one player gets a red card, you may have one player less on the field if you're on these medications. It doesn't mean you can't win the game or end with or do well in the midst of it, right? They're all immunosuppressive, some more than others, and I do agree that the TNFs are probably more so than that, and the data shows that. All require TB testing. If IL-23s have come out first, we probably wouldn't be doing TB testing on them at all. Same with 17s, because neither 17s or 23s affect your ability to build granulomatous tissue, and TNFs do. When we get tuberculum in our lungs, our body encaseates it, builds granulation tissue around it. You take a TNF, it breaks down that ability to hold it into its pen, it disseminates, all right? And that's why all the TNFs as a class have a fourfold increase of TB as a class. Infliximab, 18-fold increase of contracting TB on infliximab, the highest of all the four. Infusion, high dose, but the others, their rate is more closer to between 2.5% and 4%. And a fold increase of TB with it. So that's important to do the monitoring with it. More concern of infections with TNF by far. So if we look at that and we say, let's isolate the TNFs, the four, infliximab, etanercept, adalimumab, and centralizumab. Infections, black box warnings. History of infections, history of malignancies. You got a woman who's got severe psoriasis, comes in and tells you that she had breast cancer and had a mastectomy 4 years ago, but she really wants to get pregnant again. And I've heard that there's a medicine, sertralizumab, Cimzia, that's safer for me in pregnancy. Well, she had a malignancy 3 years ago, and there's a black box warning against using it in patients who have cancers. It may not be the best choice for you, but let me tell you, based on the registry data, all the other ones are safe, even though they don't have that same gold star. It means they don't cross over the placental barrier. So this is where that decision-making can be modified. Yes, I agree if you're going to start childbearing potential, this is a great medicine for you to be on, but not if you've just had a malignancy that would keep me from putting you on it. Makes sense? And then you see the other warnings that there are going to be with TNFs, and that is with them having any type of MS or CHF. So I think that TNFs are kind of like a targeted shotgun blast as opposed to a targeted sniper hit. Every nucleated cell in the body produces TNF, and IL-6 and interferon. Every cell in the body produces those things. Every nucleated cell in the body is producing TNF. So you're going to have 10 indications like it does, but you're going to have potentially more side effects. And this is the risk of infections that you see. Almost every infection that's out there has been reported with someone on TNF. Doesn't mean I don't use them. I differ from Dr. Lebwohl, who will tell you tomorrow that he hasn't written a TNF in over 5 years. I have written them. I've written them recently because I feel like it matches the needs for the patient itself. So black box is infections, malignancies, strong precautions is CHF in any demyelinating diseases, whether that's Guillain-Barré, optic neuritis, MS, or et cetera. All right, 26-year-old comes in pregnant. And she is severe psoriasis, wants to be on a biologic. I'm sorry, I said pregnant. She wants to become pregnant. I plan to stop my birth control pill in 6 months in order to start a family. We know that these antibodies start crossing the placental barrier at 13 weeks. These are massive antibodies. These are massive proteins, I should say, and they begin to cross over. That's a good thing. You want to have your mother's immunity beginning to transfer over before you begin to create your own. Every U.S. pregnancy has a 3 to 5% risk of developing a birth defect. That's the best pregnancy you can ever have. Never took a sip of alcohol, never stood beside someone who smoked a cigarette, took my multivitamin every single day. You still have a 3 to 5% chance of having a birth defect. Now, that's great because you can compare it to the continent of Africa where it's like 20%. We're doing pretty good with our advanced medicine. I tell patients this because when they say, will this affect my fetus? I say, what you're asking me is, it will it increase the risk, your baseline risk, which is already 3 to 5%? Will it make it higher than that? And I don't think it will. I always plant that seed because otherwise they will always say that it's the medicine they were on that did it, rather than admitting to themselves that there is just a baseline risk that is there. So when we look at these medications, if we go back to the old system, which I loved, I still wish we had A, B, C's, and D's, right? Everybody likes to get an A, right? It's not that way anymore. But with the old system, we did have these old grandfathered ones in. All the early medications were all category B's, all right? And really, anything that's come out would be a category B now underneath the old system. UVB, light therapy, is a category B. UVA, I mean, when you start using Sorlin, it's a category C. Cyclosporin, category C. And you can see, obviously, all the antherins and the retinoids are category X's. So based on registry data, these medications seem to be safe, but there's no studies that actually enrolled pregnancy into it. And the sirtilizumab, the Cimzia, gets the gold star because the way it is made, it's just a Fab fragment and it doesn't cross over. When they drew blood in the embryonic, in the placenta, and the umbilical cord, and in the fetus, they couldn't find any traces of the medication there. All right? So it crosses, but if this woman who wants to become pregnant in 6 months has a history of MS, then I wouldn't necessarily be putting her on Cimzia because it is a TNF. Or she has a history of lymphoma, right? And so, or all of these, so that's where the questions come in. All right, I'll use injections, but fewer shots are better because I might give up on it if I have to do shots too much. So let's look at dosing regimens. The fact is, this is how all patients view shots. It's like this 1700s dentist that's coming at you with this big metal tube, you know, and thank goodness these shots are really ergonomically designed, easy to give, and convincing the patients of that, I think it's pretty easy to do, you know. But when you look at dosing regimens, here's where I spell it out for you. You can kind of see some are dosed every week, which is etanercept, and then transitions over out of that. Some every 2 weeks, which is our TNFs and brodalumab, Soliq. And then you're going to see we have the spacing. You see the bimekizumab. If you're wondering what its dosing is, its maintenance dosing is Q8 weeks. If you want to hear everything about it, come out tomorrow morning and we'll talk about that because that's where the product theater is going to be. But you can see how all these, and as we moved into the 23s, we finally got into some Q12 dosing. So I think that's convenient. Compliance is great, a great indicator of success. And I think you can't overlook that, and that's things that I talk to my patients about, right? And so, but what about dosing psoriasis in kids? All right, so if we look at age, so we've got four products that you can see here that I've pointed out that are indicated for pediatrics. Enbrel down to age 4, ustekinumab Stelara down to age 6, secukinumab and ixekinumab, Cosentyx and Taltz, down to age 6. Now all the others are 18 and above, including our orals. But just look at the bottom of that list, just so you know, just in case something were to, you were to kind of tell yourself, oh my goodness, someone took something they shouldn't. I mean, when you look at the fact that you can see down at the bottom there, FDA approved greater than 6 years old Humira for Crohn's, down to age 2 in juvenile inflammatory arthritis, idiopathic arthritis, down to age 2. So in other parts of the world, several of these medications are used in the pediatric population. We just can't get them approved here in the United States, even though they may be safe in that area. So what if somebody comes in who's 14 years old, under 18, they have Crohn's disease and psoriasis? What are you going to pick? All right, I've already told you there's only 4 of them that meet the age criteria for that. Entanercept, ustekinumab, secukinumab, and ixekinumab. All right, so entanercept does not have indication for UC and Crohn's, unlike its other 3 counterparts. Entanercept's the only one. It's a fusion dimeric protein. It's never gotten the indication for Crohn's and UC, so maybe not the best based on indication. Adalimumab, Humira, does, and it's FDA-approved down to age 6 for Crohn's. So based on that diagnosis, you can put this person on it. Based on their psoriasis diagnosis, it's not indicated in the U.S. under the age of 18. So you could use that as a reason to put them on it. If you want to put them with Stelara because it's a kid and you want to give them a shot every 3 months, and maybe not even more frequent than that, then it is approved over the age of 6 for Crohn's and ulcerative colitis as well and for psoriasis. Good choice there. When you look at secukinumab and ixekinumab, they're IL-17s, but he's got Crohn's and UC. And since we know that IL-17 has 5 isomers, A through F, A and F tend to be most targeted towards psoriasis, hence bimekizumab coming out with that targeting. But we know IL-17A is gut protective. All of these medicines address A, so we see a small signal. The companies want to de-emphasize it, but the signal is there that patients can develop and can worsen ulcerative colitis and Crohn's. So it's not the best choice, particularly someone with active disease, and maybe not even the best choice for someone who has a strong family history as well. Maybe those numbers are overinflated, but I think it's still worthwhile, as the decision tree said, that it's a good indicator. So maintenance every other week, if they're gonna go on adalimumab, maintenance every 3 months, so maybe. So the takeaway is get a GI consult when they have disease. Avoid the 17s, I think, with active disease and with strong family history. Look at your dosing, and if someone's in this category, and this is how I would fall upon likely recommending to them that we try Stelara or Entanercept. Probably going to go with Stelara because of the dosing regimen, and that's how these decisions in your brain are being made as you're sitting there talking to the patient itself. Kind of make sense? And then, as I close this up, what about arthritis? Now, we know the TNFs have been the gold standard for a long time. IL-23s have the indication. The 17s have got the indication with halting of radiographic progression. Now, the 23s are indicated but do not have the halting of radiographic progression. So all of these are covering joints. Some may be actually halting progression. I think that guselkumab has now got 6 trials out in the arthritis world. They think they're going to be able to show that they halt radiographic progression as the first 23 to do that. I can't tell you if they are going to get it. I know that they're going after it. So we'll have to kind of see. Apremilast has also got approval for PSA. Deucravacitinib does not. Depression and suicide. It's double in our patients with psoriasis compared to their age-matched cohorts. Twice the incidence of depression and just having the black box warning of psoriasis itself. Now, we know that brodalumab has got a black box warning with the REMS program. That's because they had 4 completed suicides with 15 attempts whenever they're in their trials. I think that all of these medications were dealing with depression. I tell all of my patients, these medicines work so well, I expect them to get you clear. If your skin is getting clear, but how you feel about yourself is not getting better, I need to know about it. Because that's a disconnect in my mind. If I'm getting you better on the outside and you're not feeling better on the inside, we need to address it. And that doesn't matter if I'm putting them on a medicine that doesn't have these warnings at all. As a matter of fact, it's not a bad idea if every product had a REMS program because we're dealing with something that has significant increase in depression and suicide just as a disease, to be honest with you. And that's what a great point was made with Leon Kursik's article about depression. Is it the disease or is it the drug? All right, some can be administered inside the office. Some can be fall into the donut hole like tildrakizumab, may be very helpful to you. So this is what this tree is doing. I've kind of talked through different scenarios with you. You can do it as a tree. I included this in your slides. This is the grid from Dr. Duffin on how she prints this out and shows her patients. These are all the categories. This is the one I'm circling that I think is going to work well for you. We'd have to add bimekizumab to it. I didn't talk about GPP in this with spizulizumab as being a generalized pustular psoriasis. That's on the list. And this is the final summary slide. This is kind of the photo slide because it shows you TNFs, every category, and all the categories across where there's a black box warning, where there's an X, which means it's not black box, but it's strong precautions, which ones have weight-based dosing, which ones can be used in kids, which one you're gonna avoid or use with Crohn's and ulcerative colitis as a summary of all of these things. I know this is a lot to get your arms around, all right? That's what it feels like. But don't lose the fact that we are prescribing hope. We have the chance to put on a cape every day and become someone's hero. And all of these companies give us that opportunity to do that. I didn't develop any of these products. I've not been involved in any of the trials that have brought them to market. But I get to write them. And I get to be the one that gets the hug from the patient. And I get the one that gets to wear my invisible cape, you know, as I walk into the rooms. And for that, I am extraordinarily thankful and thankful for your time.